Hey, Al, great to see you. Sean, that's very kind of you. Dr. Piper, you will be missed. You will. Thanks for your leadership, and thanks for what you've done, for sharing for Mike and for all the folks that are here. My dialogue with you hopefully is a dialogue today. I have the great benefit of being in Oklahoma last week, the week before Easter, the week after Easter. We don't do votes during that time period. This is a rare moment to get 2 weeks in Oklahoma, and I'm just soaking it up. And I'll be able to take as much time as I possibly can, head back early on Monday morning and get started again. My goal for us today is for me to be able to hear what are key issues that you think need to be addressed, things that are happening here in Bartlesville or in Green Country that you think I need to make sure that I'm aware of, and for me to be able to answer some questions. I've literally traveled around the state for the last 2 weeks to just be able to visit with as many people as I possibly could to be able to take that in. Let me make a couple of comments. After traveling now for 2 weeks around the state, just about everywhere I've gone, if it's not the first question, it's the second question or the third question, but it's usually first or second. It is, tell me what in the world is going on with immigration. It's been very interesting just in the dialogue and the questions that folks have asked. So let me just clarify a couple things, and then I'm going to open this up in a minute. If you want to raise other issues on it, I'm glad to be able to continue the conversation on it. Two areas. Folks will say, tell me about this fence or this wall. What in the world is this? Well, let me help provide some background. The last four presidents have all built fencing on our southern border. And you can do the names. The last four presidents have all built fencing. There's a total of 650 miles of fence that's been built on our southern border. We have 2,000 miles total, 650 miles has fencing, and each of the last four presidents has added to that. President Trump has asked to be able to go back and repair some of the oldest fence. The oldest fence that was there, that was done four presidents ago, was actually corrugated metal, just stood up. Yeah, the stuff we put on the top of our barns, that's what it is. It was actually leftover surplus corrugated metal from Vietnam that was in a warehouse. They thought this is a cheap way to be able to use this, and they wouldn't put it up. It provides demarcation between North and South, but it doesn't stop anyone. The president wants to go back and actually put real fencing in that area, not just that corrugated metal. And then he also wants to add 100 miles of additional fencing. That 100 miles actually comes out of a request from Congress when Congress asked Homeland Security to identify the highest drug trafficking corridors where they need fencing. That 100 miles was not randomly selected. It was selected as the highest drug trafficking corridors between Mexico and the United States. And Customs and Border Patrol said, we need help in these areas. We've got to have some kind of fencing so we can help divert people that are trying to smuggle drugs into a different area or to figure out how to be able to monitor it. That's the fencing story. And I've heard lots of folks say it's exceptionally controversial, and I've just smiled and said it hasn't been for the last four presidents in a row. And it doesn't seem to be that controversial to be able to actually do something to be able to stop the flow of drugs into our country when 70,000 Americans last year died from the overdose of drugs, the vast majority of those coming from Mexico. We do need to address this. The second part of it is harder, though. You'll hear a lot of conversation about loopholes in the law right now. And it's the common media term is, we've got to close the loopholes, we've got to close the loopholes. Most folks that I asked, do you know what the loopholes are? They smile at me and say, I have no idea. I just hear that term all the time, there's loopholes in our immigration law. There are a couple of them. The biggest of them is one called the Flores Agreement. The Flores Settlement was done several years ago. It was children that are crossing the border. When that child crosses the border unaccompanied, the court came in and said you can't detain that child longer than 20 days. After 20 days, on the 21st day, they have to go to the least restrictive environment. Now, that's been interpreted by the court as saying they need to be turned over to a family member, relative, somebody else within the country. So after 20 days, by the way, it takes 35 days to process someone. After 20 days, though, they have to be released. So that means as soon as the child comes across the border, they have to start the process of what are they going to do to be able to transfer this child. That led to the huge spike that happened during the Obama administration. You remember in 2013 and 14, in those summers, when they just had thousands and thousands of children coming across the border. In 2014, President Obama declared it a humanitarian crisis and actually used bases and posts around the country, like Fort Sill and Lawton. One of the dorms there was transitioned into a place to store 1,000 children. That was in our state in 2014. That was considered humanitarian at that moment to be able to do that. Well, what President Obama declared a humanitarian crisis in 2014, for that year, we have doubled that number in the last 6 months. There's one more element that the court has added in the Flores Agreement, and that was not only that children crossing a border must be released in the country, but now the adults that travel with them also must be released into the country. So what has happened is now, 10 years ago, it was extremely rare for an adult male to cross the border with a child. Now, most men that cross the border are bringing a child with them. Most. As they cross the border, they've got a child with them, they check in. Now remember, they define a child as anyone 17 years old and younger. So they'll come across the border with a child. The child, they'll do a DNA test, and they'll say, well, I'm adopted, or that's a step-parent, or whatever it may be. And then they have to be processed in the country. They're given what's called a notice to appear. That notice to appear is a court hearing, usually 2 to 3 years in the future, and allowed to be able to work in the United States or travel anywhere they want to go in the United States while they await their hearing. Most of those individuals never show up for that hearing. Now, the word is out worldwide. I talked to the Customs and Border Patrol leader for the Laredo district, just that one district, and they said in the last 6 months, they've picked up over 50 countries coming across just that region around Laredo. Because now the word is getting out that if you want to come into the United States and you don't have a visa, bring a child with you, and you must be allowed to come into the country. That's the loophole. Only Congress can fix that. And until Congress actually steps in and says, no, you can't just be released into the country if you bring a child with you, the numbers will continue to accelerate. I visited with Homeland Security 3 weeks ago, and their statement to me at that time was, we have now have a new term that we have had to coin, and it is child recycling. Because they see the same child week after week coming across the border with a different adult. As the traffickers are moving that child with one adult, taking them back across the border and bringing them with a different adult and bringing them back across again. To my Democratic colleagues, I've said at some point we have got to address this. You can't just say it's no big deal that children are being trafficked for the benefit of adults coming in to get employment. The vast majority of the adults that are coming are not even requesting asylum. You hear on the news all the time, they're coming because of violence and asylum. The vast majority are not even requesting asylum. They're coming and saying, I have credible fear. They'll say, you need to fill out this paperwork in the days ahead and show up at this hearing. The paperwork's never turned in. There's never a formal request for an asylum, and never anyone show up at a hearing. These are folks coming for economic reasons. We have a great economy. They have relatives and family members that live in different parts of the country, and their relatives are telling them, we've got a job opening here for you. If you can get here, and here's the way to get here, bring somebody from home. Bring a child with you. That is a dramatic shift, and we have never as a nation experienced the flow of family migration, using the term family loosely, across the border. It's not happened before like this. It is something we absolutely need to address in the days ahead. And you'll hear the president keep saying, we've got to be able to fix this loophole. That's the loophole. That's one. Let me move to a second issue. The economy. I don't know if you saw the report today, but the first quarter economy grew at 3.2%. That is remarkable growth. If you go back last year, all the economic folks were saying, yes, 2018 was a phenomenal year for the economy, for job growth, for wage growth, for unemployment numbers, but 2019 is coming, and it's going to be really down. I heard it over and over again last year, so did you. 3.2% growth is twice the growth rate that we had just 4 years ago. The economy is accelerating. The Federal Reserve is actually discussing now what do we need to do on rates for the economy, because they've now hit the target of 2% inflation. We have record low unemployment. we have an unusual thing that we've not had since records were kept, and that is we have more job openings in America than we have people to fill the jobs, which is a large part of the draw that we have for illegal immigration currently, because there are so many openings in so many places. Last year, the wage growth in the country was the highest percentage growth for the lowest income individuals in the country. Their wages grew faster than anyone else, because those individuals can now compete for jobs because there are so many openings. It's making a real difference in what's happening economically in the country. The trade issue is the great unknown right now for us. We've got multiple trade agreements that are all up in the air. The one that's happening with Canada and Mexico, there is a new agreement, not NAFTA anymore. NAFTA's old term now. Now it's USMCA, which the only way I keep that straight is saying YMCA in my head and putting a US instead of the Y. USMCA, that agreement, United States, Mexico, Canada agreement, that agreement tries to be able to close in some of the issues like e-commerce. E-commerce was not addressed in the 1990s in NAFTA. It is being addressed in this one. It closes in some of the areas like agriculture for us that's extremely important in Oklahoma. Wheat, for instance, is one of the biggest issues. We ship a lot of wheat to Canada. Historically, when our wheat crosses the border, the Canadian inspectors look at it and say it's all livestock grade and downgrade it. Now we eat it and we all look pretty good, but the Canadians always downgrade it. So this USMCA agreement, one of the things it does is it fixes that issue as well. So there's lots of things that we don't normally get a chance to be able to track that we've learned a lot from that they're trying to actually resolve in that. Now, there are a couple unresolved issues. Steel and aluminum is a big one. The president used steel and aluminum tariffs to try to bring Canada and Mexico to the table. It was effective. They came to the table. Now that they're there, the president's saying, you know, I might like them. We're trying to say, you know what? We brought them to the table with steel and aluminum tariffs. Let's drop them. Because it does hurt us as consumers, because the prices go up when we have the steel and aluminum tariffs. So we're in real conversation with the administration. Quite frankly, Canada and Mexico are in pretty aggressive conversation with the United States on whatever agreement gets done to actually resolve the issue of steel and aluminum at the same time. We as a nation forget, free trade is in our DNA. We have been free traders since before we were a country. If you read the Declaration of Independence, which I hope you do, one of the complaints we had against good King George was that he was inhibiting our trade with other nations. We have loved trade since before we were a country. We're good at it. And in Oklahoma in particular, our number one trade partner is Canada. Our number two is Mexico. We do a lot of trade back and forth with them, and we'll continue to do this. And once that agreement's signed, it should move forward. Now, folks have asked me, how does it get signed? How does this get finalized? Well, that's where it gets fun. A trade agreement has to be resolved first in the House of Representatives. So President Trump's trade agreement lands on Nancy Pelosi's desk in the next couple of weeks, and she's in the driver's seat on it. Now, if you're looking at history, that doesn't bode well. In fact, in 2011, Congress approved George Bush's agreement on trade with South Korea, though President Obama had been in office quite a while, because when Nancy Pelosi was speaker before, she blocked the trade agreement with South Korea from even coming up for debate, wouldn't allow it to come up for debate. So it doesn't bode well to say that agreement is now sitting on her desk. Here's the one dynamic, and when I visited with Robert Lighthizer, our United States Trade Representative, about how we're going to get this agreement done, the first thing that comes up is, obviously it's got to start in the House. My statement is, how's that going to happen? And he said, well, it's been interesting. The House of Representatives has its own internal argument right now. There's a whole new group of folks that are just elected in the House that are avid, outspoken socialists. And they're just unabashedly, yes, I'm a socialist, Democrats that were elected. There are some old school Democrats that are also there that are trying to find ways to say, yes, I'm a Democrat, but I'm not one of those Democrats. And they're pushing on Pelosi to say the best way to say we're not them is to put the trade agreement on the floor. And those, the old school Democrats, are trying to push Pelosi to say, just allow a vote. Just do that. Pelosi does not want the president to have a win on anything, and she's been pretty outspoken on that as well. But this will be an interesting thing. In the next month, we'll find out within their party if they can push their speaker to actually just allow a vote. So we'll see what happens with that. But this is really a fist fight in the House between the socialist group and the capitalist group that's among the Democrat Party, and the Republicans are on the sidelines in the House just watching the fight. So we'll see where that goes. If that is done, that'll come over the Senate, move, and then try to get it done. We actually need to get it done in the next 2 months, not because of our elections, but because of Canada's elections. So we'll see how that moves in the next couple of months. The other issue right behind it is China. Trade with China is exceptionally important to us. The administration formed 100 items that they're working on to resolve with China. They have 75 of those they have publicly announced. They have already resolved. I believe 20 of the last 25, they've also announced they're down to the last 5 that they're trying to settle. If they can get those last 5 items settled, this is a decades in the making trade agreement with China. That would be very beneficial to us. Not only because China has very high tariffs on our products that are moving there, they blocked our products out on the whole ag manufactured products of the works, but to allow some kind of balance between the two, because they do things like dump steel on us, steal our intellectual property for different products that are actually manufactured there. There's been long-standing issues there. 60% of the world's cotton is sitting on the ground right now in China. 60%. That's a lot of cotton. But they heavily subsidize their farmers because it's a communist country. They've got to pay people to work, even if they don't need it. And they're paying people to produce cotton and then just putting it on the ground. If they ever dump that on the world market, it'll destroy the price of cotton worldwide. So there are threats like that with our trade agreement that have to be worked out that aren't obvious in the naked eye as we go through this. So all those issues are in process, and we'll see how we can actually continue to navigate that. I serve on the committee that we do a lot of the work on the trade issues, and we hopefully can get those resolved in the days ahead. One last statement, then I want to take some questions. We've worked a lot in our committee on prescription drug prices. This has been one of those moments that as a nation, we've all paused and said, hang on, why is insulin, a 100-year-old drug, tripling in price? How did that just happen? It's not like it's new insulin. It's just insulin. It's been around for a century. So we've started trying to engage in this process. How do we get more people in the market to actually do more manufacturing, especially generics? How do we deal with the biosimilars and biologics and start bringing some new drugs online? How do we deal with a company that some of the companies, if you took one drug, for instance, Humira, if Humira wasn't in a company, if Humira was a company, just that one drug, if it was a company, it'd be a top 50 company in America. That one drug. So this starts getting complicated and big and pricey in a hurry. So we're trying to be able to work through the process to wrap our arms around this to say we want people to have access to new creative inventive drugs. I don't want to discourage people from coming into the market and thinking I can invent something great and make money on it. Great. Welcome to the American system. I want that innovation to still be there. But we can't tell someone, I'm sorry, you have sickle cell anemia. If you want to get a new drug for it, it's $300,000. We can't do that either. So we're going to have to work through this process together. We're trying to be able to take it a step at a time to be able to figure out how do we make sure value is actually lined up, but people get access to real innovation, when quite frankly, a lot of the research that was done was actually done through the National Institute of Health. The drug companies just took it the last step to actually commercialize it. So we'll see where that goes in the days ahead. What do y'all want to talk about? I'm sure it was all those things, I'm sure. But what do y'all want to talk about? Yes, sir.
Talk about Social Security. I guess, are you concerned that the trust fund, we run out of money in 2035?
Yeah, I am very concerned on that, actually. The trust fund issue with Social Security is a big deal. 4 years ago, I'm trying to think if that was 4 years ago now. 3 years ago, I guess now. Last year of President Obama's term, so almost four. Social Security Disability Fund was struggling. When unemployment was so high, a lot of people were just transitioning over and requesting disability. That's been one of the very interesting things. The disability fund has actually stabilized in the last year because more people find employment and they're coming off disability because they're getting employment. So that's been really good for the disability, because there's two funds, a disability fund and a retirement fund. 4 years ago when the disability fund was struggling, the decision was made to take money from the retirement fund and move it over to the disability fund. By the way, I vehemently opposed that and lost that. But that was very frustrating to be able to watch that when there are some real fixes to the disability program that can be done. The Social Security Fund, the last time it had a major fix was under Reagan and Tip O'Neill. There was a bipartisan agreement. They looked 30 years in the future and said, this is how we can make sure we stabilize it for 30 years in the future. That has not been done. There's a group of us that asked President Obama in his last term to say the best time to do big things like this is a divided government. President of one party, Congress of another. The best time to do this is the last year of your presidency in divided government. He would not take it. And I don't know why. I really don't. And not to belittle him, I don't know why. Because it would have been a good moment to try to stabilize that fund long-term and look farther on the horizon. The closer it gets, if it's 2035 now, and it starts getting closer and closer, the ways to stabilize it get harder and harder. So when it's on the horizon, it's easier. Congress's biggest challenge is they only do something when they have to. That's why immigration, for instance, hasn't been fixed. When's the deadline to fix immigration? There's not one. So there will be a moment that Social Security will be stabilized. The challenge is how close we get to that date and how hard the fix is at that point. Yes, ma'am.
Senator, talking a little bit about perhaps a new entitlement, there's a push now in the United States that have not taken to the Medicaid expansion experiment.
Right.
And somebody's filed a ballot question here in Oklahoma, put it on the Constitution. Is there anything we can count on from Washington to make this less attractive to those who want to advocate?
So the Medicaid expansion gets lost because you hear a lot of people say, well, let's do Medicaid expansion, that'll fix it. Medicaid expansion is for typically working age, non-disabled males. That's the population that's being discussed. Working age, non-disabled males and getting health care to that group that are in poverty. Ladies and children are taken care of already in the Medicaid program. So there's two philosophical issues. How do you incentivize people to actually get involved in employment, especially with an economy like we have now, to say, let's find a way to be able to manage and get employment and get healthcare under your employer to be able to do that? That's one conversation. The second conversation is, what is the cost? A lot of folks say it's free for Oklahoma. We're just gonna get all this federal money to come in. Actually, it's $100 million in state funds to be able to do that. It's $100 million. So yes, there are federal funds that come in on that, but our state also has to find $100 million to also supplement that fund, because it's not all federal dollars. It is a difficult set of decisions, and I'm not on the state level as you are leading, in the way that you're leading well, by the way, may I say publicly. But the challenge of this is we have to be able to find ways to be able to provide greater access to people in healthcare. In Oklahoma, a lot of our solutions have been federally qualified health centers. We have 90 of them around the state, targeting those with the lowest income and the greatest healthcare risk. And they're scattered around the state. They've been extremely well managed, and it's a really good organization that a lot of people don't even notice. It literally flies under the radar, those federally qualified health centers. We also have Insure Oklahoma that we've experimented with. We have other methods that we have worked with to be able to help provide for that group. The challenge of the Affordable Care Act was it severely limited the flexibility the state had to be able to do it. Again, most of us can remember when Insure Oklahoma was growing up, that's what it was designed to do, was to be able to provide people an opportunity to be able to get health insurance that couldn't afford it at that time, especially as they're in transition. That was severely inhibited with the Affordable Care Act, and our state is still looking for other ways to do it. By the way, one of the things the administration did is they opened up what's called associational health plans. It's one of the things a lot of us have really pushed for, allowing small businesses and sole proprietors to be able to join in with others to increase their risk pool, to allow basically small businesses to have the same benefits that big businesses have on health insurance. If you're a big business, you're always protected for things like pre-existing condition. HIPAA laws require that. You're joining in a bigger risk pool, you have guaranteed issue, all those things that happen when you're a large business. When you're a small business, you don't get that same benefit. If you do associational plans, you can. You can join in an association even across state lines to get into a larger risk pool. Our state chamber has a plan like that, where people can join into it and actually get the benefit of a large company, though they may be a small business. There are creative ways to be able to deal with this. And the challenge is, what's the right fit for us in Oklahoma to be able to do it, that we can actually afford? Yes, sir.
You know, I heard nothing but good things about you.
That's a rumor.
I'm a junkie, and I watch morning news all the time. And I look at Congress, and the only thing I see on TV is they always introduce something, but never gets passed through, or they're writing a book. That's all I see done over the last 12 years that I've been really paying close attention. And you talk about Social Security. When I applied for it, I thought the parking lot was full. And I thought, my gosh, there's a lot of old people here. Me and one other lady, the only two people over 62 years of age. And you're talking about getting people back into the workforce, but when you give them opportunities to draw a disability and not have to work, you're not helping guys like me, because I struggle finding people every day. Yep. So my whole deal is, I've heard nothing but great things about you because they say you're a tremendous person. But I don't see you guys in Washington doing anything. You're always saying, well, if we have everything, we'll get this done. But now you have a separation of power. But I don't see anything being done. Yeah.
So that, by the way, exceptionally fair question. It is the joy of serving as a legislator with 100 other people on one side of the building and 435 on the other side. It is my favorite Winston Churchill quote is, Americans can be counted on to do the right thing after they've tried absolutely everything else. We're exceptionally, painfully slow process. What I was saying about Congress doing something when they have to, that's really what I've seen. And it's been my most frustrating aspect about being a legislator, is that when we get to a deadline, Congress will actually act. But until there's a deadline, they rarely do. And it is very, very frustrating. There have been some things that have moved. Big criminal justice bill that actually moved last year. It's a bipartisan bill that had been in process for years. The tax bill that got done. That was a very significant reform of our tax system. We did a improvement on banking, the Dodd-Frank rules, and trying to be able to open up for community banking and regional and rural banks especially, provide them greater flexibility. That got done. So there have been some things that have gotten done. But the big things, Social Security, infrastructure, Medicare, Medicaid, immigration, they all sit out there. There are about 5,000 bills a year that are filed, or per session for 2 years, about 5,000. A couple hundred of them will actually pass. So it is very frustrating to see the number of things that you'll say, okay, we're talking about this, but it's not done. So can't disagree with you on that one. It's the nature of a legislative body. It's also the nature of everybody's focused in on all cable news, all talk radio, all everything, all the time on it. And there's a bunch of folks just locked up. By the way, it'll only get better during a presidential election year. Yes, sir.
Yes, I wonder if you'd expand on your view on it, on immigration, as to your view on the level of support Mexico has for the administration efforts on immigration.
So Mexico in particular has been quietly supportive and publicly disruptive,
yes.
If I can say it that way. Mexico, several months ago, started giving what they're calling humanitarian visas to individuals leaving Central America across their southern border, giving them 21 days to transit through the country on a humanitarian visa to be able to come to our border and cross. When the administration stepped up about a month ago and said, we're going to shut down the borders unless Mexico does something, that was the something that the administration was so mad about, was how Mexico was basically just turning away. If Mexico doesn't enforce their southern border, we can't keep up on our southern border. Because most of the individuals crossing our border are not from Mexico. They're from Honduras, Guatemala, and a third group, El Salvador, but mostly Guatemala and Honduras right now. That's Mexico's southern border. So they've got to be able to enforce that. They've got to be able to stop folks transiting. And when they know someone's being trafficked in persons, they've got to be able to address that. But Mexico's biggest challenge is 40% of the country, they don't patrol anymore. It's run by the cartels. 40% of the landmass, the cartels run it. So the federales don't even go in those areas overnight. They'll go in and force and leave. But there are large sections of Mexico that our State Department, the state just south of Texas, in Mexico, that state has the same rating from our State Department as Syria and Yemen for the level of violence. And it's all the cartel violence. Now, there's kind of a running statement of from our Border Patrol folks that you can enforce a border with personnel. Mexico does it every day, because you do not move through that part of the country unless the cartel signs off and approves it. So it is exceptionally difficult what's happening right now there. Yes, sir.
I get to talk with you often enough that I know your views on this, but I think it's important the room does. 5 months, roughly, till the end of the fiscal year. I know your attitude on getting the budget passed in regular order.
Yeah.
Where are we at this point in time with 5 months left to go in the fiscal year?
So, thanks, Charlie, by the way. Your recorder's kind of smoking a little bit. Is that okay?
That's okay.
Okay, yeah. the five months left in the fiscal year, we should be, through the appropriations process, have a what's called a budget document that's passed, both from the House and the Senate, have an agreed on number and start writing appropriation bills to that. That number has not been set. The House actually, and I mentioned before the division that's happening among Democrats in the House Democrats have not agreed on a number, and so they've agreed they're not going to do a budget at all. The Senate, which has to be a bipartisan agreement to be able to actually pass that budget and be able to work through, has also punted and said the budget requires that it has to balance within 10 years, and we're not sure we know how to do that anymore, that anyone would actually vote for, and so we're going to deem a number on our side. Let's just pretend that we had a budget number, and they're working with the House and Senate leadership right now so they can co-deem a number and then start writing the appropriation bills to it. If they deem the number and start working through that, then appropriation bills can be written. They have to be complete by September the 1st. But as you and I have talked about, every year it seems like we gripe about that the budget didn't work again this year. The budget process was written in 1974, right after Watergate. It's only worked four times since 1974. Four. So this is not a new thing that the budget process didn't work again this year. That's the normal process right now. There were 16 of us, 8 Republicans, 8 Democrats, that we met all last year trying to find some new way to do the budget, the process itself. Thinking if we don't fix the process, we're not going to get a better product. The 16 of us could not get that resolved, but there is a group I'll affectionately call the Righteous Remnant that we're still working of that group to see if we can't actually pull a group together, a bipartisan agreement for how we fix the process. It is doable. In fact, the Federal Fumble Book that I put out every year, the whole first section of it is here's how we could do budgeting better, and just making the proposal. Here's what this would look like. And what I'm basically asking my colleagues to do is read it, look at it. You can agree or disagree. If you disagree, propose something different. If you don't, here's an idea, and see if we can actually get this done. But we've got several of us, and some that you would be shocked that I'm working with. Sheldon Whitehouse could not be more liberal and left from Rhode Island as a senator, but he and I are working together on several budget issues to try to figure out how we fix the process. The budget process should not prohibit us from actually getting to a budget and getting to appropriation bills. And I try to remind everybody, we have 12 bills that are required we do every year. There are those 12 appropriation bills. They're all 12 bills on spending. There is not a required bill that we do for savings. There's not one. And as I mentioned before, we do what we're required to do. And if there's not a required savings bill, it won't happen. So I have affectionately proposed a 13th bill as required every single session. And that is at least once every session, Congress has to agree on a number for savings. Not going to set what that number is. They could save $5 or $500 billion. But set the number and have to have an agreement. We're going to save this amount and then put in process what it's going to take to actually do that. I think that starts us down the process. Best way I can illustrate this, by the way, and this is not going to be fun, we have $22 trillion in total debt. Now, deficit is the overspending in 1 year. Debt is the collection of all those deficits. $22 trillion in debt total. No one can wrap their head around $22 trillion. So I transitioned it to 22 trillion miles. You know how far it is to do 22 trillion miles? It is the distance from Bartlesville to Pluto and back 3,081 times. Bartlesville to Pluto and back 3,081 times. That's 22 trillion miles. Do you understand why most folks in D.C. have stopped talking about the budget? Because it's so far out of balance, it's like, no, I'm not even going to talk about it. If I can encourage anybody, it's lean in and keep the conversation going. Because we've got to allow folks to be able to internalize, this is how bad it has become. The inattention for so many years, with lots of folks that have been pounding on it verbally and saying we've got to get on it, but little action, to go back to your statement. The last time there was a significant move, there was a bipartisan agreement to actually move on anything on this, was 2011, the Budget Control Act. And it did limit spending for a couple of years. It actually had an effect. But we're a long way from that. And we've got to get back on track on this. Yes, sir.
What is your comment on the elimination?
I think we need to keep the Electoral College, quite frankly. And as an Oklahoman, we would want to have that. The Electoral College was put in place because the early states were terrified of Virginia. Virginia was the big state. And a lot of the early leaders were from Virginia. And they knew if they didn't have an Electoral College, no one would ever campaign outside of Virginia. And every person ever elected would be from Virginia because they knew every other state population-wise would be irrelevant. Well, if we get rid of the Electoral College, everyone who's elected is going to be from either New York, Illinois, Texas, or California, or Florida. And every campaign will be in those five states to try to run the number up as much as you can, and we will never see anyone in Oklahoma. So the best way for us to be able to protect the rights of every single state is to keep an Electoral College and force the process. It's not like the rule is new. It's been around for a couple centuries. It's pretty well known. And for those who complain about the Electoral College, I'm like, everybody knew the rules at the beginning. You're probably just complaining because you lost. But the rules didn't change. Those were the rules of the start, and they're the rules of the end. Okay. Yes, sir. So the Equal Campus Access Act shouldn't be an act that we have to do at all. This should be just like a no duh, why do we need to talk about that? But it's not. Several years ago, starting in the state of California, California universities started reaching into faith-based college student groups and saying, you have to allow people that disagree with you, not in your membership, but in your leadership, or we won't allow you to be on campus. So let me take this home. If you had a Muslim student group, a Jewish student group, a Christian student group, they would say to you, you as a Muslim have to allow Christians and Jews to be in your leadership. You as a Christian have to allow Muslims and atheists to be in your leadership, or we won't allow you to be on campus. Now, every one of those groups all said, whoa, we will allow anyone to join our group and to be a member of our group, but leadership is restricted to people that actually philosophically agree with us. That doesn't seem like that crazy of an idea. That seems like, you know, association that's protected. But California would not allow that. Now, we all thought that's a crazy idea and get kicked out immediately. The Ninth Circuit loved it and kept it. And it's now moving to other states. Now in Iowa, the same thing is happening at the University of Iowa, with they're kicking people off campus if you don't allow people in the leadership of the organization that also disagree with your organization. That's absurd. If a Christian group wants to say something as crazy as, if you're going to be a leader in our Christian organization, you have to be a Christian. I know that may sound radical, but that seems kind of nonsensical to me to be able to push it outside. So we actually have a bill that we're pushing our way through right now that's both a signal to the Department of Education to say we need your engagement on this issue. That's also a push on messaging and also a message to the courts to say, listen, we have full expectation that when we have a First Amendment, we mean it. That you have the ability to be able to associate who you choose to associate with and have independent free speech even on campus. So we're working our way through the process. Now, whether we ever get a vote on that, I don't know. But we're working our way through the process on that to try to address this. Again, where are we as a nation that we would say, if you don't agree with me, I'm going to silence you? Where did that come from? We as a nation have said historically, I want my opinion in the public square, so I'm going to make sure your opinion is also shared in the public square and that you're free to be able to do that. I am tenacious about protecting the faith rights of other people of other faiths because I want to make sure that I have the opportunity to be able to share my faith long term and my children's children have the opportunity to be able to live their faith. But yeah, we'll stay on that from there. Does anybody have one last burning question before I get in trouble for asking? Yes? Go ahead.
Senator, a big hot topic has been the special counsel's report. Could you tell us your opinion on that and what do you expect going forward?
Well, we're out of time. Sorry. So let me just say it this way, and I do need to be quick because I want to be able to honor everyone's time here. Y'all have all got to go make money and pay taxes and all those things. We spent as a nation $25 million in 2 years with the Mueller report. If you go through the Mueller report, the first volume of it, and they do break it up as volumes, the first volume of it begins with, this is how much leeway we were given to do our work. We had 19 different attorneys. We had 40 FBI agents that were assigned to us. We did 500 interviews. Here's all the places where we got grand jury availability. Here's every bit of research that we could go through. Here's all the documents we were able to see. Basically, they spend the first pages outlining and saying, we went everywhere we wanted to go. We looked at everything we wanted to look at. We got as many subpoenas as we asked for. We got unlimited access. And they just listed out all the things that they were able to do. And then they break into collusion, cooperation, conspiracy, all those wonderful things. They break through all that, and at the end of it say, yes, absolutely, the Russians were trying to interfere in our election, and here's the chronology of what they did, starting all the way back in 2014. But we found no evidence that anyone in the Trump campaign was ever working with them. Yes, the Russians were trying to interfere in our elections and trying to find ways to connect, but no one in the Trump family or in the campaign was involved in it. Then you flip to volume two. And they say, here are 10 big questions on obstruction of justice that people have asked us to answer here, the 10 big areas. And we're not going to make a decision on this. Number one, because you can't prosecute a president. That's under DOJ guidelines. So it's not relevant, but we're gathering all the information. And if Congress wants to speak on this, they're able to. But here's what we found. And they start going through things like they fired Jim Comey. By the way, my biggest surprise in firing Jim Comey was that it took 6 months. I mean, that was really my biggest surprise because both the Hillary campaign and the Trump campaign were both furious with Comey by the end of the election. And we forget that during that time period, everybody was mad at Comey. You don't see FBI directors on TV every day. Does anybody even know the name of our FBI director now? That's the normal position for FBI directors, that they're not out on TV all the time. Comey was on TV all the time and was constantly out there making statements. Very atypical. I was shocked he was there 6 months. Basically, what they came back with on the Mueller report was the president was really mad about the investigation and said it a lot. And you've got to decide whether that's obstruction of justice or not. Now, I'm not shocked the president was mad about the investigation. He made that very clear from the beginning that he didn't like it. The question is, everybody's saying he would have fired these people, but his staff wouldn't let him. Okay. This was a guy who had a reality TV show about how to fire people. Okay, I don't think he doesn't know how to fire. I don't think people are walking around going, oh, I thought I fired them. What are they doing still there? Okay, that's not President Trump. If you've ever been around him, if he wants somebody to go, he puts so much pressure on them that they want to leave. Or that he just calls him in the office and says, we're done. Okay, he knows how to be able to move people out if he chooses to do that. So this whole argument that he really wanted to obstruct justice, but his staff didn't let him, just doesn't bode well with the reality of what you really see in that White House and with him personally. What I do expect is for the next 18 months, we're going to see every week a new hearing on something. Every week. Democrats are right now arguing over impeachment or not impeachment. The new Democrats are all saying, let's impeach. I ran on that as a campaign. We need to do it. The Democrats that have been there a long time said the Republicans made a mistake when they impeached Bill Clinton, and it guaranteed Bill Clinton would be reelected because the American people felt compassion for him, saying it's not fair he was impeached for something that was, they felt like, not relevant. By the way, Bill Clinton was impeached for obstruction of justice. We lose track of that, but that was the charge for impeachment, was obstruction of justice. All of us remember Monica Lewinsky and all that kind of stuff. That was not it. It was that he was trying to stop the investigation about Monica Lewinsky, and that's why he was actually impeached. So they're all saying, hey, this would be a bad idea. Let's resolve this at the ballot box, not an impeachment. So I expect over the next 18 months, there'll be lots of noise, there'll be lots of hearings, but I don't expect them to actually move to impeachment, because they know politically that'd be a horrible mistake to be able to go through the process. Everything would be dominated by the American people would say, didn't we see the report? Didn't Mueller say with $25 million of investigation and 500 interviews that there's nothing there? So I don't think they'll actually follow through on it. And I think the same thing on the IRS stuff. They do have the right. The chairman of Ways and Means, the chairman of Finance Committee, does have the right to pull any American citizens' IRS returns, but it's extremely rarely used, and it's not been used for political means in the past. I hope they will not set a new precedent for weaponizing IRS returns, because what they'll do is they'll set the precedent to say at some future Ways and Means chairman or chairman of the Finance Committee, if they don't like a certain journalist, they'll go pull their IRS returns. If they don't like a certain environmental group, they'll go pull their IRS returns. If they don't like a person that's campaigning against them, they'll go pull that. That is a terrible line we never need to cross. You may agree or disagree on whether the president needs to turn his returns over, but weaponizing returns as a political vehicle, I think, is a terrible idea for us to ever do as a nation. And I hope they won't pull that trigger in the days ahead. And so we'll just see. For those of y'all that are completely frustrated now, let me just say, I firmly believe that there is a God who is still in control and does still have a plan in our life. I have a piece of art in my office. If you've ever been to my office and you get to D.C., come by on a Wednesday mornings. We have coffee on Wednesday mornings. There's a piece of art in my office that is made entirely out of broken glass. And it is a beautiful piece. It's broken glass that's reblown. You would never know that it's broken glass. The piece is actually from an Oklahoma artist. He calls it a redonto, Italian for redemption. He's a Christian, so am I. But the picture of it is how God takes that which is broken and other people would throw away and remakes it. I absolutely believe that my Father has not lost track of our nation or of our lives. We have a responsibility to do, but I refuse for people to say we're too far gone. See, I know in my own life, I've had moments I've been too far gone. And my Father redeems broken things. So I only say for us, let's lean in. Let's keep working. Let's keep mentoring younger folks. Let's keep engaging with our families and nonprofits. We desperately need that. And let's keep at the wheel. While there's still daylight, let's stay at work.